Great. Thanks very much for the opportunity to talk to you all here in the colloquium. And as Daniel said, I'm going to talk about gravity and the search for new physics using cosmology, using gravity as a probe. Now, before I get into the main part of my talk, I want to remind you a few things about gravity. So first, I'm hopefully going to get you excited about gravity and remind you that gravity is really awesome, and it's done phenomenal things for us since the beginning of the scientific endeavor of doing physics. I'll then talk about cosmological perturbations and how gravity is integral to their description, and then give you two examples of ways that I've used gravity to probe new physics with cosmology recently. So one, we'll be talking about the properties of dark matter and how you can constrain something called dark acoustic oscillations with gravity. And the other, we'll talk about how you can constrain the properties of neutrinos from cosmology, again, using gravity. But first, the fun part. Okay, so gravity is you know, I would argue the most important force in the universe. It plays this pivotal role of shaping things, and that's because it's usually attractive in its long range, and so eventually it wins out and becomes most important. And it makes the universe interesting, not boring, because it allows, you know, interesting places to exist, like the Earth. You know, if we didn't have gravity, we wouldn't be here standing on the Earth. The Earth wouldn't exist. So that's great. And so all the compact objects in astrophysics are a result of a balance between gravity and some other non-gravitational physics. And then, as you go to larger scales, we build up the rest of the stuff in the universe by having gravitationally bound, you know, compact objects, and those are the things we see when we go out and look at the universe. So basically, gravity is central to everything that we do, certainly in astrophysics, and perhaps all of physics. So, just stepping through here, right? Gravity allows us to have planets, so we have a competition between gravity and fluid and degeneracy pressure that allows us to have stable objects like planets. Stars exist because gravity is battling the nuclear energy that's released in their cores. White dwarfs are the competition between gravity and electron degeneracy pressure. Neutron stars are the competition between gravity and neutron degeneracy pressure. And then, of course, eventually gravity wins and you just have black holes. And this is the laundry list of known astrophysical objects that we have. And these are the things that we can assemble together to make, you know, you put a bunch of stars together gravitationally with some gas, and you get things like the galaxy. Okay, so we're hit here 8 kiloparsecs from the center of the Milky Way galaxy. And putting these galaxies together, of course, we end up with clusters of galaxies, the largest gravitationally bound objects in the universe are superclusters, so collections of clusters of galaxies. And this is all structures built because gravity exists. If we go one step further, then of course we have the large scale structure of the universe, and that is the scaffolding of that galaxies live within, that is built up gravitationally. So we have this web of cosmic structure, and in the knots of the web are where are clusters and regular galaxies are, and we happen to live here at the center of our observable universe, and we look out and see this web of structure that was created by gravity. So, since the time of Newton, his great insight was that all things gravitate in the same way, and that allowed him to explain how things on the surface of the Earth, how their dynamics of how they're falling is equivalent to how the moon is orbiting the Earth. And one of the key things that have insights was that all things gravitate in the same way, independent of their composition and only depending on their total mass. So if you go and calculate something like the gravitational potential energy of a sphere, then it's not going to depend on the composition, what kind of atoms it's made of, if it's even made of atoms, as long as it's particles with mass. And so this idea of universal gravity is going to be key to allowing us to explore the possibility of new physics just by assuming that gravity continues to be universal. Okay, so I want to play a little game here and test your knowledge of the history of physics a little bit. So this is a game called Gravity's Wrong or New Physics. And let's get started. Okay, so you should be able to get this one if you've been paying attention. So in 1854, Helmholtz suggested that gravity could be the source of energy that powers the sun. And if you go ahead and calculate the Kelvin-Helmholtz time for the sun, so this star collapses and releases energy from the gravitational contraction, the age of the sun should be about 20 or 30 million years. But at the time, or a little bit after that time, geological and biological evidence suggested that the Earth was billions of years old. So what's going on? Gravity's wrong or new physics? New physics. Okay, that one was easy, right? I gave you the answer earlier, but this is new physics, of course. So nuclear forces make stars stable for billions of years. And so, in 1860, someone could have said, well, there has to be some new physics that's involved at the cores of stars and that's releasing this energy. And then that's why, you know, the star is billions of years old. Okay, next question. All things gravitate, even light. And so in 1800, this guy, Soldner, calculated that in Newtonian theory, if you have a ray of light passing close to the surface of the sun, it should be bent by 0.875 arc seconds. And Einstein repeated this calculation, got the same answer initially. And then in 1919, Eddington measured that it was actually twice the value. Gravity's wrong or new physics? Gravity's wrong. So it turns out to describe the deflection of light, you need to use general relativity. And so Einstein replaced Newtonian gravity with general relativity. The important point is that in general relativity, gravity is still universal. So the key idea gravity, everything gravitates the same way, is still there in Einstein's theory and is perhaps has a better explanation. And so you need general relativity to describe things like the deflection of light from the sun and also to describe gravity on the largest scales and describe cosmology. So one of the key points in general relativity is that gravity is not sourced only by the mass of things, but also by the pressure and stresses that the distribution of matter has as well. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Oh, so you get to divide by the mass of the particle that's being deflected, so it only depends on the acceleration. But if you might be happier saying, okay, let's apply the equivalence principle and calculate how much the photon is deflected. And if you do that, you get half the right answer. And to get the full answer, you have to include the fact that space is curved. Okay, you get. Next question. This is a timed quiz, so. Okay, in 1933, Fritz Zwicky went out and measured the velocities of galaxies in the Coma Cluster. And he calculated how massive they would have to be in order for the cluster to be self-gravitationally bound. And he found that the mass was much larger than the light in each of the galaxies individually. In the 1970s, Vera Rubin also went out and looked at the rotation curves of galaxies and found that the stars were spinning too fast compared to the amount of light there. So again, there was missing mass. Gravity's wrong or new physics? Yeah, it's a dangerous question to ask here, maybe. Well, I think it's new physics. I think that's the most elegant explanation. And I think the most convincing evidence from that has come recently from the CMB, in that we can measure how much baryonic matter there is in the universe using the CMB. And you still need extra non-relativistic particles, which the predominant paradigm now is we have these new invisible dark matter particles that gravitate but don't interact efficiently with the standard model particles. Okay, so gravity. If we assume gravity is universal and is described by general relativity, then this is pointing the way towards new particles, new physics that exist in the universe. And finally, the most recent example was in 1998 by looking at type 1a supernova, the Supernova Cosmology Project and the HiZ Supernova search team discovered that the expansion rate of the universe was accelerating. So this is the equation that describes how fast the universe is accelerating. It has a negative piece and this positive piece due to the cosmological constant. And if the universe is accelerating, this cosmological constant piece has to dominate the equation. And so there's something like dark energy that seems to be causing the universe to accelerate. Gravity's wrong or new physics? No answer. I don't know, could be both. But this is exciting, right? So this is gravity. If we think we understand gravity, this is pointing us towards new physics. Or maybe we don't understand gravity in some kind of subtle but fundamental way. So this is exciting. And gravity is pointing us towards new physics. So I claim that historically, and hopefully still now, gravity is a messenger that tells us that new physics may be out there. And so in particular, even if it's impossible for the particles that we're made of, the standard model particles, even if they have no communication with new physics in a hidden sector, at minimum, there's still gravity. And because this invisible stuff, like dark matter, like neutrinos, which interact very weakly, because they gravitate, we can see that gravity using visible matter, the same way Zwicky and Vera Rubin have done so far by looking at structures in the universe. So there's basically two paths to get to the dark universe, and one of them is just having a direct connection between our visible sector and the dark sector, and the other is the guaranteed path through gravity. So we don't have to have this path. It makes life perhaps more interesting if we do have that path, because we can learn things directly, but we can also learn things using gravity. And in the context of cosmology, I'm going to mostly be talking about how we can use cosmological perturbation theory to tell us about what's going on in a hidden sector using gravity. So I'll give you a quick 7-minute review of cosmological perturbation theory. It won't be everything, but hopefully it'll give you a flavor of what you need to know to understand the rest of the talk. So the key insight in Einstein's formulation of general relativity is that the matter and stresses in the universe curve space, and so the matter creates the geometry of space. So we have on the left-hand side of Einstein's field equations geometry that describes how the metric behaves, and on the right-hand side we have the matter and energy and stresses. If we take that to a cosmological context and we say we live in a homogeneous universe, it's the same everywhere, then things can only depend on time. And this left-hand side describes how the universe is expanding over time in response to the matter, the densities and pressures of the matter in it. Okay, so this equation is the Friedman equation that describes how the universe is expanding. Now that's if everything is perfectly smooth. If we imagine that from place to place there's tiny inhomogeneities, then we can write down a perturbed metric that describes how the stuff in the universe curves. I don't know why it's... Do you guys see that? Blurry? Okay. Hopefully that's not too annoying. Describes how the stuff, the perturbations to stuff in the universe, the perturbations to photons, neutrinos, baryons, and dark matter change the metric. And they cause gravitational potentials to be set up in the metric. So psi and phi are gravitational potentials. And the things in the universe can be described mostly as fluid-like. And so we have variables like delta R, which is the over-density of, compared to the average of some radiation in the universe, and theta R, which is the divergence of the velocity field of that radiation fluid. So we get an equation like this, which is basically the continuity equation in the presence of gravity, and this equation here, which is basically the Euler equation for linear perturbations. So if we combine the equations to describe how the fluid moves around with Einstein's equations for gravity, so an example of one is here. So we have the Laplacian of the potential plus some other stuff, time derivatives, is 4 pi g times the density. Okay, so if these terms are small, this is just the Poisson equation for gravity, and we recover the Newtonian limit. But if you're talking about large scales, then these gradients are small, and the gravity responds to the expansion of the universe instead. Okay, so these equations are the basic equations of cosmological perturbation theory. and they're in real space. But the nice thing about these equations is they're linear, so we can do the trick that you always do in physics, and you move to Fourier space. So we replace all the gradients with minus I times k, and now we get equations in Fourier space, which are, instead of being partial differential equations, are now ordinary differential equations that can be solved, you know, either analytically or numerically, independently for each value of k. You may have noticed that there's two potentials here instead of one potential in Newtonian gravity, and that's because in general relativity, gravity is described by a spin 2 field instead of a scalar field. And there's a variable here I've been calling psi, or capital psi, and that's the thing that becomes the gravitational potential in the Newtonian limit. And there's phi, which becomes, it describes the curvature perturbation instead. The difference between these is sourced by the shear stress of matter in the universe. So if the matter is being sheared in some way, or if it's traveling in a way that induces shearing in other stuff in the universe, then you get this difference between the potentials. In detail, you can look up these equations, and for instance, there's a reference paper by Ma and Birchinger in 1995, which goes into this in gory detail. But the key thing is, this is the equation I just showed you. This is the Poisson-like equation. And there's another equation that, instead of having just phi on the left-hand side, has phi minus psi and the shear stress on the right-hand side. So this is going to become important when I talk about the constraints you can put on neutrinos. So how does this communication between the invisible universe and the visible universe happen? Well, basically, every one of these terms on the right-hand side are perturbations to the stress tensor. So this one is delta T00. That's basically the density perturbation. And this is the total density perturbation that includes both the invisible universe and the stuff we can see, the visible universe. So delta T00 is a sum of the density perturbation in the visible and the invisible. And the gravity doesn't know where this is coming from. Gravity is universal, so inside the gravitational potentials, inside the response, the evolution of the invisible perturbations is going to force the evolution of the visible perturbations and allow us to see what's going on. Okay, so we're looking for new physics. The conventional paradigm for looking for new physics, say if you talk to a particle physicist, would be go to the LHC, and you would collide particles at the center, and you build a detector all around it, and you see what stuff flies out, and you reconstruct what happened at the center of your experiment, and you see what comes out to a distance. So that's one event, but what you want to do is you want to run the same experiment, scattering particles at the same place many times, and then look and see what you saw and search for new physics. So that's one way you can look for new physics in this kind of particle physics setting. I'm going to claim that cosmology is doing a similar thing but in a sort of a dual way. So if you look at the CMB, for instance, that I claim that's a primordial particle physics experiment because you're colliding particles at a distance and seeing what comes into the center. And you're running the same scattering experiment everywhere. So in the case of the CMB, it's electrons and photons scattering off each other. But you're doing it in many places, all around us, on the surface of last scattering, at the same time. So you're repeating the experiment but in space rather than in time. And you can use this to search for new physics. So in the LHC, you set up initial conditions. You set up two protons very carefully that collide with each other and produce things like the Higgs boson. In the case of the CMB, you set up the universe to have correlated overdensities of the same particles everywhere in space. So you have a region that has a little bit more dark matter, a little bit more photons, a little bit more baryons, a little bit more neutrinos initially. And then you let those perturbations evolve. And because these different particles have different properties, they evolve in different ways, but they evolve according to the same theory everywhere. And that allows you to probe the physics that they evolved according to. So at the LHC, you repeat the experiment many times and record all the different outcomes. And in cosmology, like I said, you perform the same experiment everywhere in space, but you have random initial conditions. So there's some kind of function, some Green's function, that describes how these perturbations evolve in real space. And you have random values of the curvature, the local curvature of the universe, everywhere in space, and you convolve this evolution function with the random curvature fluctuations to generate the observed universe, and that's how we can invert it to get back at what the physics was, how these things evolved. Okay, so the early universe is a controlled physics experiment where you start off with particular initial conditions, and then by looking at how different components of the universe evolve, we can learn about this physics. So the first example I'm going to talk about is constraining the properties of dark matter using this technique. And this is work that I've done with, most recently with Francis Yance, Racine, Roland de Putter, and Alvisi Racanelli at Caltech. And it's also based on earlier work that Francis and I did when he was a student at UBC. So the basic idea here is that if all or some fraction of the dark matter that we think is out there, if we believe in universal gravity, was coupled to dark radiation, then at early times, when the coupling between these two fluids was efficient, there would be sound waves in the combined system. And so the basic idea is that the radiation has lots of pressure, and the pressure from this radiation will push the dark matter around until the time that the dark matter decouples from the radiation. And this combination of the length scale that this dark matter gets pushed around is a characteristic scale, the DAO scale, the dark acoustic oscillation scale. And this gets imprinted and remembered by the matter distribution of the universe that we see today. So if we go out and look at galaxies today, we should see this scale. And so we can detect it gravitationally. Now, another way you could phrase this is that this is the dark side of sound, which is perhaps a scary thought. Apparently, with this two disc album, that was the idea, is that dark sound is something you should maybe be scared of. But I want to calm you down. I want to say, don't be afraid of the dark. It could be interesting. It might have new physics. And actually, we don't have to talk about the dark universe at all in this context. We can talk about things that you like better, like photons and atoms. And we can talk about baryonic matter and baryon acoustic oscillations. Right? So if all of a fraction of the baryonic matter couples to radiation, then the combined system will support sound waves. So this is what happens in the real universe. Photons couple to electrons, which communicate the photon pressure to all the baryons. The baryons get pushed around by the photons, and this imprints the characteristic scale, the BAO scale, on the universe that we can go in and look for. So the physics of this is just, like I said, Compton scattering couples the photons to the electrons, and the Coulomb scattering communicates that coupling very efficiently to the protons and helium atoms. And there's basically two epochs in the history of the universe as far as Compton scattering goes. There's one where the Compton scattering is efficient and the Compton collision time is very small compared to the expansion time of the universe. And there's the time when it's inefficient and basically photons and baryons are not coupled. At the level of the equations, this shows up as a piece in the photon and baryon velocity equations that couples the velocities together if the Compton collisions are efficient. Okay, so if this is some inverse time scale, if that's very small, this term here has to be very big, and the only solution is going to be if the photons and baryon velocities are the same. Okay, so if the photons are moving in some direction, if you have a wave packet of photon sound waves moving over here, they're going to push the baryons along with them, just like a snowplow. If we go to the limit that things are very efficient, then these equations simplify enormously. So basically, these collision terms are forced to be zero, and we get a system like this, which has three variables, the density, the velocity, and the gravitational potentials. And it turns out there's an exact solution for this in terms of spherical Bessel functions or sines and cosines. So chi here is basically the time variable. And if you go to very late times, so if you talk about some Fourier mode that enters the horizon, then at times far after the time that it entered the horizon, you can ignore all these terms. And the density becomes a cosine solution. The velocity becomes a sine solution. You guys have all seen that before. Of course, that's a harmonic oscillator, right? So at late times, if you look at how this relativistic fluid it behaves, it just behaves like a harmonic oscillator, and that's just telling you that you have sound waves that are propagating through the universe. So that's the simple version, the ideal version. In the real universe, the sound speed depends on time because the ratio of the energy density of matter and radiation is changing over time. And so really, it's still a harmonic oscillator, but it's a forced harmonic oscillator with a time-dependent effect of mass. But the basic idea is the same. The baryon and photon fluid, the matter radiation fluid, supports acoustic waves. And these waves will propagate until it ceases to exist as a single fluid. In the case of baryons and photons, this is when atoms form and you have recombination, the electron density plummets. And the Compton scattering shuts off. And then after that, the photons move ballistically through the universe at the speed of light, and then they can be detected by Planck and WMAP and all of these fantastic satellites. and the baryons stop moving where they are and start to gravitate and start to draw in dark matter to where they stopped, and this scale gets frozen in the universe. So what is this scale? So for a perfect radiation fluid, the pressure of the fluid is exactly 1/3 of the energy density of the fluid. The sound speed is this combination here, the derivative of the pressure with respect to density. So it's 57% the speed of light for a perfect radiation fluid. So if you take that number and multiply by the time that these atoms formed, that recombination happened, you get this characteristic scale of the baryon acoustic oscillations. In the real universe, you have to put in the microphysics. You have to actually figure out how the sound speed evolves as a function of time. But we have the technology to do that. And so we can go ahead and calculate what this scale is. And this turns out to be 150 megaparsecs, roughly. And it's the same scale that's showing up in the CMB, as well as in the large-scale distribution of matter in the universe. So just visually, just to drive this point home, if we start off with our controlled experiment, we have this overdensity of baryons and photons at the same place in space. So this is a 2D thing, but you can imagine that it's actually in 3D, and we have spherical shells of sound waves propagating out from some center. Then initially, the baryons and photons are right on top of each other, and they move in lockstep. Okay? Until the age of the universe is about 100,000. And at that point, the photons start to decouple from the baryons. And you can see that the photon picture is now more fuzzy. And that's because the photons are diffusing out of the location where the baryons are. And eventually, the photons completely decouple and fly away, and we can see them in our experiments, but the baryons stay fixed, right? So they got pushed along some amount of time, and then they got frozen, and you get this characteristic scale. So this is just a movie of this that Daniel Eisenstein has made. And so you can see that the baryons get pushed along, and then at late times, they draw the dark matter in, and you end up with this overdensity in the total matter distribution. If you look at the correlation function of matter in the universe today in real space, so if the correlation function is this expectation value here of the overdensity, and it tells you the excess probability compared to having an uncorrelated distribution of seeing matter a certain distance away from an overdensity. And you can see that this correlation function has a peak around 100 H inverse megaparsecs. H is about 0.7, so this is around 150 megaparsecs. This is in real space. If you go to Fourier space and you transform some sharp feature in real space into Fourier space, then in something called the power spectrum, which is the Fourier transform of the correlation function, you see oscillations. Okay, so these oscillations are the same oscillations that have been observed in the CMB. The reason you see these oscillations, there's other physics involved, but the basic idea is that you're Fourier transforming this characteristic scale. It's also been observed in the distribution of galaxies. So if you look at galaxies, if you think galaxies trace matter, then this BAO scale has been seen by several groups, including the Sloan Digital Sky Survey in 2005, and more recently, Wiggle Z in 2011. Okay, so this idea that radiation can push matter around in the early universe, and we can see that, is not new. This is exactly the physics that generates the CMB. And so you shouldn't be afraid of the same thing happening in the dark sector. Okay, so let's talk about dark acoustic oscillations. So the idea is we're going to imagine that a fraction, it could be 100%, it could be less than 100%, of the dark matter is interacting with some kind of relativistic particles, the dark radiation. So the parameters we're going to use are the fraction of interacting dark matter. We're going to use a parameter Z, which is the ratio of the temperature of these dark this dark radiation to the CMB temperature, and that can be related to an effective number of extra neutrinos in the universe. That's just a bookkeeping device. It doesn't mean there's really extra neutrinos. It's just a way to account for the extra energy density. We also have a dark matter, dark radiation interaction cross-section. So this is the new physics. So this cross-section divided by the mass of the particle is the new physics that we are interested in constraining. And we're going to parameterize it using capital sigma DAO, which is just a particularly nice way to do it for the model we used. Examples of this type of physics are atomic dark matter. So that's a model where you basically make a copy of hydrogen, but you change the mass and the fine structure constant of the constituents, and you try to make a model that acts as dark matter, and it has this similar physics to hydrogen, so that's why it has this dark radiation dark matter physics. Another example is very similar. It's called double disk dark matter, and that's a model proposed by Lisa Randall and collaborators, which is essentially the same as atomic dark matter, but instead of having all of the dark matter interact, you just have a fraction of the dark matter interacting. But I want to emphasize that this is not limited to those kinds of these particular models. Any model where you have relativistic particles that have lots of pressure that can push dark matter around will behave in a similar way. Okay, so the physics is similar to what I just described to you. You have to calculate the sound horizon of this dark matter, dark radiation plasma, and that depends on the evolution of the sound speed, which depends on the microphysics of your model. It turns out that in most models, you can calculate an approximation to this, which is the second expression here, and so you can get a handle on how big the dark acoustic oscillation scale should be and how it should depend on parameters like the fraction of interacting dark matter. So it turns out that it's inversely proportional to the square root of the fraction of the interacting dark matter, and proportional to the temperature ratio squared. And we'll see this play out when we get to the constraints. So we get equations that are very similar to the photon baryon case, but now just instead of having Compton scattering, we just say there's some kind of dark radiation scattering time that depends on the microphysics. But otherwise, we get the same modifications to the Boltzmann equations that couple the momentum of the dark radiation and the dark matter. Okay, so onto the constraints. So if we go and put this fraction of interacting dark matter into the codes, then we can see that you end up with extra peaks in the correlation function. So here is the standard BAO peak. And for different values, which is, it's a little bit hard to see here, but for different values of the coupling strength and the fraction of interacting dark matter, you get different peaks showing up in the correlation function. Clearly, these examples here are not compatible with the data. And so that's why you have the power to constrain this physics, because you don't see these peaks. Okay, so we're constraining the physics of invisible dark matter using the gravity that it would have induced and imprinted onto the matter distribution of the universe. It also modifies the structure of the CMB itself. So at the time of last scattering, 60% of the energy density of the universe is dark matter. And so if you change the properties, if you change how the dark matter is distributed, you end up changing the CMB directly. So this is an example in a case where 100% of the dark matter is interacting in this way, and you get these adjustments to the shape of the CMB power spectrum. Another powerful probe is CMB lensing. So as the photons from the last scattering surface travel through the universe and come to us, they travel through the matter distribution of the entire universe. That's mostly dark matter. And if the dark matter has a different distribution, then you change the way that CMB photons get deflected. And so we can use CMB lensing to constrain the properties of dark matter. So this is an example of the Planck lensing data and different models of interacting dark matter. And you can see that generically what you do is you suppress the amount of lensing that you have, and this makes it incompatible with Planck data. So again, this gives you a way to probe the invisible universe using gravity. And finally, just as a basically maybe a pointer of things to come. So this is the B modes of CMB polarization. So normally you don't have, there's two types of CMB polarization. There's E modes and B modes. Normally you don't have B modes, but lensing converts E modes into B modes. And the way that the E modes get converted into B modes depends on the distribution of dark matter in the universe. So this is the recent SPT Herschel initial indication of B modes in the CMB. And these are different models of interacting dark matter. And as you can see, you get variation in the B mode. So as these constraints improve, then you're going to get better and better constraints on the fraction and strength of dark matter interactions. So these are the constraints we find. So combining Planck, WMAP polarization, and large-scale structure data and CMB lensing, we find that this parameter sigma DAO has to be less than about 10 to the minus 3, or the ratio of the temperatures has to be less than about 0.3 in this region. So this is sort of the interesting region where the dark matter is interacting relatively strongly. On this side, we recover a constraint that Z should be less than 0.6. That's equivalent to the existing constraint from Planck on the number of relativistic species. So we have this transition. Over here, we have the fraction of interacting dark matter and the strength of the interaction. Again, we find above 10 to the minus 3, the fraction of interacting dark matter must be very low. Below 10 to the minus 3, you can get away with 100% interacting dark matter because the interaction is weak enough. It's the ratio of the cross dark matter, dark radiation interaction cross section to the mass in some dimensionless units. It's like the Thompson cross section divided by the electron mass in the baryon photon case. Yeah, so it just turns out that those chains take a really long time to converge. So we've done a bit of that, but we've also done this complementary thing of just fixing the parameters and seeing how much things change. And the idea here is that even though we've changed the interacting fraction between 5% and 50%, the constraints on these parameters are roughly the same. So they're quite robust. So sort of the key result here is that is this plot on the right. And so if sigma is greater than 10 to the minus 3, then sort of the most conservative statement we can make is that less than 5% of all dark matter is allowed to be interacting that strongly. So, you know, so 95% of dark matter must have never interacted with any relativistic particles in the history of the universe. And that's what we've got using this CMB data, and that's been communicated to us by gravity. And just in detail, these are the probability distributions for two slightly different combinations of data, one using BAO Sloan data and the other one using DR9 data. And they're quite consistent. There's some marginal preference for an interacting fraction of maybe, you know, 2% or something, but it's not statistically significant. So the bottom line is that less than 5% of the dark matter could have ever been interacting with dark radiation. Okay, so that's putting constraints on dark matter, and then very quickly in the last few minutes, I'm going to talk about work that we've been able to do to do a similar type of thing for neutrinos. So, yeah. Yeah, that's good, because you reminded me of something that I wanted to mention. So part of the motivation for doing this was that recently there was this double disk dark matter paper by Randall and collaborators where they said, well, okay, if 5% of the dark matter is interacting, then it could cool and form an extra disk in the Milky Way. And isn't that interesting? And what we find is actually that's not allowed by cosmology. So for the parameters they wanted to be able to cool efficiently and create this extra disk in the Milky Way, cosmology doesn't let you do that, because you only get to pick the physics once. Now, their model, I wouldn't say we've ruled out their model, but we've put it into a different corner. So, right, neutrinos. So, as I said, dark matter is 60% of the stuff that's around at the time of the CMB, but even though neutrinos are a very small spice of the entire density of the universe today, at the time of the CMB, they were 10% of the universe. So we can play the same game and try to put constraints on the properties of neutrinos at the time that the CMB was forming. So the CMB is what I would call a metricometer. This may be a terrible word, but anyway. So the way that the photons travel through the universe depends on the metric, and the form of the scalar perturbations, the vector and tensor perturbations, determine how the temperature fluctuations and the polarization fluctuations that we see appear to us. I'm going to focus on scalar perturbations, and the main thing here is that there's these two kinds of scalar perturbations in general relativity, the the one that's sourced by basically the density, the gravitational potential. And then there's this delta psi scalar that is sourced by the shear stress of stuff in the universe. And at the time of the CMB, in the standard model, we have both densities and shear stresses. And so the idea is that we can use the CMB as a primordial shearometer, where if you have no delta psi, then the photons move a certain way, and that means you have no shear stress. If you have delta psi, then you have shear stress. So the shear stress is normally created by neutrinos. So recall that Fermi came up with a way to describe the interactions of neutrinos. You have these contact interactions that have a strength of G Fermi, which is exceedingly weak. It's 10. This is a dimensional coupling constant that has a strength of 10 to the minus 11 MeV to the minus 2. And if you ask what temperature, what time the neutrinos decoupled, then it was about 1.5 MeV. So this is the visibility function of neutrinos. This is when neutrinos last scattered off of other particles in the universe. And in the standard model, this peaks at around temperatures of 1.5 MeV. So subsequent to 1.5 MeV, the neutrinos move ballistically through the universe at the speed of light, and they induce shear stress. So this is important because it's known that the evolution of photon perturbations, which are the things we see when we look at the CMB, depends on the fraction of relativistic particles that are free streaming versus not free streaming. So that's this ratio R nu, and normally neutrinos are the only things that are free streaming. So R nu divided by rho gamma plus rho nu is 40%. 40% of the radiation in the universe is supposed to be free streaming at the time that the CMB is sent to us. And if this fact means that the density perturbations of photons are suppressed by some factor that depends on R nu, and they are phase shifted. And this was pointed out in a nice paper by Basinski and Seljak in 2004. And so this has been used in the past to argue that neutrinos are really there in the CMB by Trott and Melchiori in 2005. And I have done some earlier work on this type of thing. So the idea here is we're going to use the CMB to do a neutrino-neutrino scattering experiment. So that's kind of interesting because no one's ever done a neutrino-neutrino scattering experiment on the Earth before, because getting beams of neutrinos together is a hard business. But in the early universe, we have lots of neutrinos that are flying around for free. So this experiment has already been done. We just have to interpret it. This is a recent paper from earlier this summer where we did just this. So the idea is we're going to imagine that neutrinos have extra secret interactions, that they scatter off each other more strongly than they interact with electrons or other particles in the standard model. And we're going to try to constrain that, because if we have these extra interactions, then the peak of the neutrino visibility function, when the time that they last scattered, will get shifted to lower redshifts. And so we can put a constraint on the effective strength of these neutrino interactions by looking at the CMB and seeing when the neutrino started to free stream. The signature of this is missing shear stress. So if the neutrinos are still scattering at the time that the CMB was formed, then there's no shear stress in the universe at all, and the photon perturbations evolve differently. And so, just to illustrate that, this is a single K mode of the shear stress, the total shear stress of the universe, for different values of the neutrino self-interaction strength. And so if it's big enough, then you just suppress the shear stress, whereas the normal case, it's peaking around 1. Okay, so that's in K space. If you go to real space, this dotted line is the standard neutrinos that are free streaming. They're free streaming at the speed of light, so they've traveled the furthest distance. This green line is the standard case of photons. And the blue and red line are interacting neutrinos and photons. So when you have interacting neutrinos, then they move in a similar way to photons. If you don't have interacting neutrinos, then they get ahead of the photons. And the way I like to think about it is basically they gravitationally pull the photons along with them because they're moving at the speed of light and the photons are nominally only moving at the speed of sound, you know, which is whatever, 50% of the speed of light. So this effect is at an early time. It becomes more subtle at late times, but it still is a big enough effect to change the CMB power spectrum and allow us to put constraints on the strength of neutrino self-interactions. And this is the result. So not surprisingly, there's some interaction strength below which the neutrinos are free streaming at the time of the CMB and act just like in the standard model. So there's this interaction strength of around 10 to the minus 3.5. If G effective in units of MeV squared is less than 10 to the minus 3.5, then the neutrinos act like the standard model neutrinos, and that's the limit that comes from the CMB. The surprising thing was that we actually found a preferred region of this interaction strength around 10 to the minus 2 MeV to the minus 2. So that was not anticipated at the outset. And what's going on is that you can make the neutrinos self-interacting, and that modifies the CMB, but you can compensate by changing the initial conditions of the universe and recover a CMB power spectrum that looks very similar. So these are two different models, one of them coming from the standard cosmology and one of them coming from this interacting neutrino cosmology. And they have different initial conditions and different evolution, but they end up with the same CMB power spectrum. So that this is why you end up with this extra peak showing up out. I'll get to that in a second. Okay, so basically you have these two possible regions. So one is the standard case in this island, and then you have this little island here where there really is, it's not allowed over here, it's not allowed over here, but it's allowed right here. There's a sweet spot where you're allowed to have this interacting neutrino cosmology. Well, so it makes interpretation a little harder here, because to make this plot here, we assume that this is all Bayesian statistics, and we assume that we have a uniform prior on the log of this parameter, log G effective. Okay, and that gives you that shape probability curve. But but there's no reason, you know, to choose a log prior a priori, and so if we chose a linear prior instead, then you would prefer the interacting neutrino cosmology. So interpretation of this is from my perspective, is that we just need additional data to constrain this. At the moment, there's two modes that seem to be compatible with cosmological data, and you can apparently get away with having extra neutrino interactions. The parameters of this are almost the same, except for dark matter and the baryon content and H naught and various other things. The different parameter is the scalar spectral index, which is, instead of being 0.96 for the standard cosmology, if you have interacting neutrinos, it needs to be 0.935 or something like that. So you're changing the initial conditions, changing the evolution in a way that's degenerate. So I think the standard case is slightly better by like one. So yeah, it's I mean it's definitely, but then at the end of the day you saw those spectra that I showed and it's like if you can really reproduce it then it's I don't know how to you get into the muddy waters of debating statistics. So yeah, that's all I'm saying. I'm not saying that nothing is preferred at all. I'm just saying they're both consistent. And if someone goes out and does a neutrino scattering experiment and they find that neutrinos don't scatter, then you can get rid of the other mode. But if they do scatter, then you get rid of the standard cosmology. Okay, so just to wrap it up, so I hope I've convinced you that gravity is a really powerful tool that allows us to look at invisible things, and in particular allows us to constrain the physics of dark matter and neutrinos, and that's because invisible stuff still gravitates and modifies the distribution of the things we can actually see. And if that didn't convince you, then hopefully this will. That's it.
So as usual, we like to give students the first chance for questions. So are there any students that have questions? Okay, maybe let everybody ask questions now.
We heard from this morning from the new large underground xenon experiment Lux that they see nothing below zeptopan cross sections. Below 10 to the minus 45 centimeters squared.
Yeah.
It's a zepto cross section. And they claim they've excluded low mass WIMPs. Also, LHC has excluded neutralinos and supersymmetric particles, some of them up to 1.2 TeV. So if this continues, what does this mean about dark matter and dark matter cosmology and so forth?
Well, I mean, if this continues and you think dark matter is a particle, then that what it's telling you is the kind of constraints that I talked about today are the best we're going to get. If we don't have this direct interaction with standard model stuff, then gravity is our, for better or worse, is our only tool.
So have you thought about neutrinos from 1987A? That the fact that they can reach to us, that puts an upper limit.
Yeah. In our parameter, actually, Coleman Turner had a paper on this in 1988, and the limit is 10 to the 2 MeV to the minus 2. So it's so much larger.
It's four orders of magnitude larger than yours. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Is it possible to distinguish between your two neutrino scenarios using lensing effects?
Yeah, so I guess that depends on whether the neutrinos have mass or not. So that's another layer that we want to get into, but we we wanted to do the simplest thing first. But if they have mass, then I think yes is the answer.
So you're currently using massless neutrinos in your model?
Yeah.
Next question. Okay, then let's thank Chris again.